Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University History Department titled Development and the Global History of Distributive Justice. Our speaker is Jeremy Edelman, Professor of History at Princeton University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University History Department Chair Bruce Shulman.
On behalf of my colleagues, it's my great pleasure to welcome you. Jeremy Edelman is the Henry Charles Lee Professor of History and Director of the Global History Lab at Princeton University. Now, Edelman's website description somewhat mysteriously informs us that he has lived on four different continents, but only three are discernible from his bio. Educated at the University of Toronto, the London School of Economics, and Oxford University, he is also the author or editor of, I think, a dozen books, which include Frontier Development, Land, Labor, and Capital on the Wheatlands of Argentina and Canada, published in 1994, Republic of Capital, Buenos Aires and the Legal Transformation of the Atlantic World, 1999, which won the American Historical Association's Atlantic History Prize, Sovereignty and Revolution in the Iberian Atlantic, and last year, Worldly Philosopher, The Odyssey of Albert O. Hirschman. Many in this room will also know him as one of the authors of a leading world history textbook, Worlds Together, Worlds Apart. He has another book on the way, Latin America, A Global History, forthcoming from Princeton University Press, and is currently working on a book about the history of the world as an idea. His remarks for tonight are entitled Development and the Global History of Distributive Justice. Please join me in welcoming Professor Edelman. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the generous introduction. I won't divulge the fourth continent. So what I'm going to talk about today is about a project that I've been thinking about for many years. And so I'm going to try out some ideas with you appreciate your patience and forbearance as I plow through 100 years of history. It's part of a larger story concerning arguments about the world as an integrated, divided, and precarious place. And it focuses on how we've thought about obligations and to ourselves and to others, including those who are not yet born. It's about our global imagination. The story starts in 1853 with Karl Marx, who penned some ill-tempered but prophetic words about India's economic integration into the British imperial order. His essay had some astute observations about the mutual, what he called the mutual dependence of mankind and the means of that intercourse, and I'm going to do that obnoxious scarecrow thing just to indicate where somebody else is talking and it's not me, and I hope it'll be clear who's doing the talking. So what he called the mutual dependence of mankind and the means of that intercourse. Before our eyes, he noted, that mutual dependence was transforming mankind's productive power. Trade and industry were yielding conditions of the new world in the same way as geological revolutions have created the surface of the earth. And Marx's polemic ended with a famous passage many of you will be familiar with: the market of the world and the modern powers of production were fated to become the instruments of the most advanced peoples. At that point, quote, only will human progress cease to resemble that hideous pagan idol who would not drink the nectar but from the skulls of the slain. As opaque as it is lurid, this phrase has consumed commentators for as long as Marxism has been a creed. And I guess we chewed on this back at Oxford in the 1980s. But what has often been forgotten is Marx's basic insight at the dawn of the first modern globalization. Capitalist integration brought bounty for some and submission for others. Therein was born a conundrum of our era: the commingling of economic interdependence and social disparity, the production of wealth and inequality within the same economic and social frame. Nowadays, this issue of the relationship between interdependence and inequality is evident everywhere. It's the subject of relentless consternation and outrage, as if it were the upshot of tremors that only recently realigned the plates of world capitalism. In Marx's spirit, though with more style, Naomi Klein has cataloged the malfeasant campaigns of Milton Friedmanites to turn the world into a laboratory for their laissez-faire experiments and financial gurus' prescriptions of shock therapy, those are her words, narrated in the moral voice of a witness who stumbled upon a new reality, which is why it's so shocking. That was the book that she produced that turned her into something of a celebrity. Klein's bestseller captured a moment of revelation. The 2008 financial crisis only added to the view that skullduggery of credit default swaps and mortgage-backed derivatives was fundamentally new and could be attributed to rogues who simply needed to be cleansed from an otherwise sound order. An influential way of ruminating over the causes of and remedies to divisive, what we could call divisive integration, has been development. Thinking about development provided a compass for arguing about the world as a divided unit. It functioned at a global scale in the same way that social democracy did at the national level. In other words, the arc of the history of social democracy and welfare follows the same trajectory as that of development. So development and social democracy were in a fundamental sense born of the same process and motivated by the same needs to give intellectual and political bearings for understanding how global capitalism made wealth and disparity at the same time. Socialism and development, though, did more than just explain. They also contained within their analyses prescriptions and policies aimed at transcending the divides by conjuring an alternative model of integration, so producing not just an analysis of divisive integration, but what an alternative would look like, one which would be more just. At heart, they were concerned with distributive justice as a corrective to the natural workings of the marketplace to redistribute what the marketplace had so unevenly sorted. In the 20th century battle over great and horrific ideas, development became a powerful way to consider global redistributive justice. And by this I mean that it offered arguments for redirecting the flow of valuable resources from winners to losers in the service of an alternative concept of global order. Now, the evidence of the puzzle of divisive integration was all around by the end of Marx's century. Three fundaments laid the basis of this convergence: a new critical class, intellectuals, the recognition of international economic interdependence, and the conjoining of colonial peoples to metropoles, therefore preconditioned the birth of the modern concept of development. Now, fortunes could not be severed from world economic events. They were connected, like cycles in lending and borrowing money from London financiers. The world price of wheat or rice had profound influences on the welfare of millions around the planet. While Frederick Jackson Turner declared the open frontier closed at a Congress of American Historians, Thorsten Veblen, that very same year, pointed out some uncomfortable truths about the fate of farmers locked in a vicious cycle of harvesting more wheat to compensate for falling prices. Globalization had brought prosperity to hinterlands, but it also brought perils. The end of the 19th century did more than anticipate the challenges of farmers around the world who left their self-sufficient ways to reap the bounty of the marketplace. It also summoned social scientists to serve another aspect of global integration. Wars in the Philippines, South Africa, Cuba, Korea, as well as a global tide of enclosures of barbarous peoples around the world pit imperial powers against others whom they now had to govern. American Marines and German troops found themselves plodding through tropical forests in the Philippines and Namibia with ethnographers and photographers in tow to pursue villagers and guerrillas who had different ideas of governance and property than the scientific conquistadors. We've edged in very slowly to the 20th century with a purpose, to show how the first modern globalization yielded a recognition of interdependence and division. In its wake came questions about the underlying distribution of power and resources. It did not take the First World War to reveal the fragility of the global order, its unfairness, or its cruelties. Scandal and the urge to explain the nature of interconnectedness kept writerly classes and photographers busy well before the Balkan crisis erupted. But the war and the Great Depression did kick the legs out from under the certainties of old liberal convictions about civilization and scientific ordering. The year 1919 was year zero for the idea of development, if only because it pulled the veil back on the injustices of the global order. A wave of revolt circled the world. In April 1919, clashing with police in Punjab led to the Amritsar massacre and the spread of the non-cooperation movement. A month later, anti-imperialist demonstrators took to the streets of Beijing to protest the transfer of German concessions in Shandong and founded the May 4th movement. If Europeans could plunge the world into ruin and reclaim privileges afterwards, then it stood to reason perhaps the welfare of peripheral peoples would be better served by charting other pathways and different norms and reasons for global integration, which is the core of the development proposal. And ever since, there has been a furious debate about whether the have-nots would be better off as part of the global order or free of it. What could not be rolled back was the acknowledgement that fundamental inequities were now at stake. Invariably, the drive to catch up to industrial time and create legible, reformable societies turned the gaze to the agrarian question. It had haunted socialists like Lenin and Kautsky, who wondered how one could have socialism in countries where many lived like 16th century peasants. And the solution for some tyrants was to collectivize or to starve the peasantry out of existence in the service of accelerating the catch-up. And there were others, like Mahatma Gandhi, who saw farmers and villagers as the bedrock of an alternative telluric order necessary to counter the moral and environmental degradations of progress. And ever since, Gandhi's sermons about self-sufficiency and the merits of rural simplicity have been touchstones for a branch of environmental thinking. But there were contemporaries who thought about how progress combined and entangled different kinds of historic time into a single order, mixing within societies what the world market combined across societies. Just to take one example from the Peruvian Marxist José Carlos Mariátegui, observed that the integration of Andean peasants into the modern world economy as producers of maize or metals hardly dismantled the old vestiges. It gave them a new lease on life. In other words, the integration of Peru into the world market by exporting its products didn't dismantle the old colonial relics. It gave them a new lease on life. This was an important insight, for Mariátegui observed the cunning ways in which global integration relied upon and reinforced older versions of organizing societies. Backwardness was not a relic. It was a creation of progress itself. Institutions like mines and plantations that relied on a gamut of coerced labor systems bounced back. Ancient Andean, feudal, and modern systems overlapped and interlinked, which yielded the illusion of pulling the country forward while watching it drift backwards. The elements of three different economies coexist in Peru today, he noted in the late 1920s. Underneath the feudal economy inherited from the colonial period, vestiges of the indigenous communal economy can still be found in the Sierra. And on the coast, a bourgeois economy is growing in feudal soil. It gives every indication of being backward, at least in its mental outlook. The development of the capitalist economy, he went on, was entrusted to the spirit of the fief. the advent of market forces, the penetration of foreign capital, and the rise of modern cities did not automatically tear down the leftovers of the old world. It recombined them for modern purposes. In Europe, capitalism dissolved feudalism. In Peru, capitalism revitalized it. The problem of the clash of times. With the growing awareness that integration created new hierarchies, coupled with the unsettling effects of the First World War and doubts about liberal capitalism's ability to resolve social conflicts, we see the beginnings of development as a solution that may require correcting international flows. And at its core were the misgivings, hesitations, and uncertainties about the world that had been built up over the previous century. As George Orwell noted, in part autobiographically in his essay To Kill an Elephant, the imperial inspector in distant lands has become a sort of hollow, posing dummy, the conventionalized figure of a sahib. He wears a mask, and his face grows to fit it. In fact, nothing was fitting very much anymore. If 1919 was year zero for spotlighting global injustice and the Depression led to defections from the liberal trading order, the Second World War provided a new global moment for redistributive justice. The difference between the two post-wars, 1919 and 1945, was the entrance of the United States onto the world stage, dragged, one might say, by the ideological threat of another new actor, the USSR, and its developmental appeals, and the full bloom of anti-colonialism. It is common to locate the struggles over recoiling empires within Cold War dynamics, but we could equally invert the way we think about the Cold War by immersing the Cold War within a larger arc of struggles over global justice. Note the importance of pre-war debates about economic redistribution involving Latin American Washington, that even before the war had happened, there were influences that Latin American economists and pressures that they had been exerting on Washington to design a new economic architecture after the Second World War. And so many of the figures who would appear in 1945, 44, 45 to design the global order had already been exposed to Latin American thinkers about global economic order. The point is, the pressure to embrace development was coming from outside the charmed circle of statesmen and social scientists that we usually suspect of thinking globally for everyone else. In other words, the Latin Americans were having their impact. And lest the powerful forget, as Mahatma Gandhi noted in a letter to the American president that summer, the promises, this is of 44, the promises sound hollow so long as India, and for that matter Africa, are exploited by Great Britain, and America has the Negro problem in her own home, unquote. Development was increasingly seen then as an enterprise devoted to one part of the world, that is the have-nots, at the expense of another part, the haves, that there had to be some redistribution in order to make development work. Justice took on an explicitly then redistributionist mean by these delegates, and its claims acquired more antagonistic features after Bretton Woods. To challenge deep-seated norms, rules, and institutions, it then fell to national planners, the new heroes of the story, to punch through the entrenched hindrances. Social scientists joined forces then with the planner, and sometimes the two became one. Fresh from the New Deal, war and Reconstruction, it was an alliance, the planner and the social scientist, that made sense. And no one framed this coalition better than the Argentine economist Raúl Prebisch and an entourage of social scientists at the new United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America, called CEPAL. Indeed, they positioned themselves explicitly as the counterpoints to the Bretton Woods free marketeers. By the mid-1940s, Prebisch had turned on his earlier faiths in liberal internationalism, not because he'd become more radical, but because he'd become more sober. He felt that the rules and organizational defaults of the trading system that had been reconstructed in 44-45, this trading system had punished primary exporters and siphoned wealth from the peripheries to the cores. In 1945, Premish started to refer to the plights of what he called the periphery in letters to his friends, an indication of how the vocabulary was starting to label global injustice. In the CEPAL offices in Santiago, an unsure and frustrated Premish, he was unable to get particularly the United States and the British to listen to the call for global redistribution. He poured into his what was called the economic development of Latin America and its principal problems, which is known as the CEPAL Manifesto, a declaration of discontent against the global economic order. Though couched in technicalities about elasticities of demand and business cycles, the normative purpose came through. Not only were primary exporters stuck in a historic rut and condemned to diminishing rewards for their staples, but unequal exchange, which was the term that they used, would fossilize them there. In effect, the past was becoming a prison. If Prebisch and his predecessors had once thought that international integration was the key to breaking out of poverty, the CEPAL Manifesto argued the reverse. The only solution was to turn inward, to reap the rents that once flowed out to industrial powers. Prebisch represented a cognitive style of his age. Underdevelopment was an intractable condition that required dramatic solutions, big pushes, shifts to internal markets, breaking of unequal trade. There was little small about the style, and the scale would loom large. Prebisch's Brazilian colleague, Roberto Campos, called this a structuralist diagnosis. Structural problems demanded structural solutions because, left on their own, peripheral societies would fall further and further behind. So nothing short of structural change could reverse the course. The change in mood from 1919 is now undeniable. Anxiety about the world order meant dealing directly with the have-nots. The ability to stabilize Europe was riding on the wars in Southeast Asia. Troubles in Africa were starting to loom. And next door, reformist governments calling for domestic redistribution and economic nationalism from Guatemala to Argentina forced a reluctant and often confused hand in the White House. Mixed into the anxiety was a particular kind of faith. Buoying the idyll of technical assistance was the precedent of a homegrown development scheme, the Tennessee Valley Association. American ingenuity coupled with American social science became a formidable duo. To the Tufts economist Eugene Staley, American dams could serve as a model for intervention in poorer countries as a way to neutralize totalitarianism. Staley coined a term, modernization theory, to denote an understanding of historical time. Whereas the likes of Sun Yat-sen and Mariátegui had conjoined archaic and modern features that then reinforced each other, often in a perverse way, Prebisch had argued that peripheral progress was doomed to stall. Right. So his argument was he could not move forward. Latin America and the rest of what would be called the Third World was doomed then to stall. What modernization theorists argued and insisted was that the timeline of modern urbanization and industrialization could be replicated, not rejected. Development meant mastering time in order to accelerate it. A social science in this key had a special appeal for Americans, or for Europeans transplanted to a land of optimistic bravura. At the apex of its global influence, and in the wake of a war that demolished the confidence in European modernity, American social science was flush with assurance. What is more, in the hands of some social scientists, the American miracle could be rendered less miraculous. It could be stylized for export, stripped of its redemptive exceptionalist storyline to fit a universal plot. Through migration, urbanization, adopting clockwise understandings of time, and deferring to authority based on merit, modernizers could be made right for democracy. What had happened in the United States was, in this sense, a beacon for all other emerging, so that when you first see the term emerging, they're called emerging societies. Now they're called emerging markets, thanks to a World Bank economist who wanted to take the stigma out of Latin American debtors in the 1980s, so he invented this term called emerging markets, and boy, did it catch on. Well, the term emerging also emerges after the Second World War to describe these new societies. And in a fit of optimism, the advocates of modernization insisted that all good things go together. Growth begets democracy, and democratic life creates the right environment for sustained growth. This was the model. And the trick was getting off to the right start, isolating and capturing what were then called the preconditions to growth, without which the whole enterprise would falter. It was a creed ripe for muscular intellectuals disposed to export the confidence in their models. Indeed, one might argue that it was the great American intellectual export. The ultimate goals of development, noted Walt W. Rostow, the wunderkind of the new confidence, to an audience were psychological and political. One of the hubs of this kind of thinking, the Center for International Studies at MIT, I don't know if there are any present here, opened a branch in New Delhi in 1955 to persuade Indian social scientists, I'm going to draw David even more into this conversation, to persuade Indian social scientists and policymakers of the wisdom of modernization. Shortly thereafter, MIT Brain Trusters unveiled a proposal for an aid policy for India. Now, aid starts to enter into this picture, connected with this idea of reorganizing time, aimed to win friends and stymie enemies. But, they warned, it could easily backfire, lest the accelerated change unleash the demons inherent in the awakening of formerly static people. They're locked in time, they can't move until our aid starts to kick in. And from that hub, MIT, came Rostow's The Stages of Economic Growth, subtitled A Non-Communist Manifesto, a book that quickly earned a kind of Talmudic status and went through 12 printings in its first 5 years. It was a distillate of Rostow's understanding of the Industrial Revolution in England, mixed with lessons about how to shake traditional societies from their timeless lethargy. Tradition, he argued, immunized people from science and the rewards of its application. It prevented villagers from upkeeping their roads, stymied productivity, and condemned them to a perpetual cycle of diminishing returns. Unable to break out of the cognitive lock imposed by the past, villagers proved the verities of the dismal science. Determined to turn Robert Malthus onto his head, Rostow aimed to show a way out of the darkness of the past. For the poor, quote, to enjoy the blessings and choices opened up by the march of compound interest. Where the virus of compressing years into quintiles spread most was actually in the communist world, where the master planners of capitalism, in an alliance with social scientists, what they dreamed up was nothing compared, in the United States, was nothing compared to the development utopias of the party chiefs. In 1957, Comrade Khrushchev announced at a gathering of world party leaders at a Congress to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the October Revolution that the Soviet Union was committed to eclipsing American industrial output in 15 years. Not to be outdone, and frustrated that China was still inching after 1 5-year plan, Mao then proclaimed a great leap forward to outdo British industrial output in 15 years, only to plunge much of China back into the Stone Age. 30 million people starved to death in 3 years in humanity's worst manufactured famine. What happened in China should have set off some alarms about development thinking. Except for a few dysphoric voices, it did not. We have a paradox, then. While the apostles of modernization faced more and more criticism from their colleagues on the left and on the right, and the cataclysmic example of mass starvation in China should have given pause, the 1960s saw development reaching its zenith. The United Nations declared the development decade. American foundations rushed to support work in what was now called, after 1957, the Third World. The World Bank became a full-throated global development agency. It had originally been designed for the reconstruction of Europe, devoted now to recycling member contributions to build dams, in the process of redistribution of resources, to build dams, railways, factories, and ports around Asia, Africa, and Latin America. When the White House approached Albert Hirschman, I like this photograph in particular. I could do a whole series of photos of Albert Hirschman standing on his head, because, in fact, that's what he was trying to do to the social sciences, afraid that it was going down a road to a certain kind of dangerous orthodoxy. So the White House approached Albert Hirschman to join the Alliance for Progress, I'm sure you're familiar with, to join the Alliance for Progress team as part of the best and the brightest. He was taken aback. Had his recruiters not been reading his warnings about the delusions of the master planners? The alliance was, he conceded, a vast improvement, which isn't saying a whole lot, a vast improvement over past doctrines that had held Latin America's economic development that could be safely left to private capital, unquote. Washington was even preparing to get serious about commodity market problems, which had been so abhorrent in 1945. The administration would even condone agrarian reforms once the crux of the coup d'etat, say, in Guatemala in 1954. But therein lay the rub for Hirschman. Would there not be something distasteful to Latin Americans about having financed social justice for them? In the cause of redistributional justice, then, Washington threatened to make things worse, according to Hirschman, by fusing its moral concept of justice onto the social scientific certainties of the master planners. If Hirschman was prophetic, his voice was lost in the more general clamor to connect development and aid, to connect development to aid and aid to massive planning efforts. By the time Mr. TVA himself joined the Johnson administration, which was fretting about what to do over an imploding South Vietnam, to oversee nothing less than a Mekong Delta Development Authority, only a shrinking circle of insiders had any confidence that the scheme would pacify, never mind develop, war-torn Indochina. Many were starting to question the underlying assumptions of development talk altogether. The Martinican psychiatrist Frantz Fanon was among the first to call attention to the hypocrisy of developmentalism and its sibling, anti-colonialism. After serving in North African hospitals, he invoked the acidic words of an unnamed Senegalese patriot, disenchanted with the promises of the poet President Senghor. "We ask for the Africanization of the top jobs, and all Senghor does is Africanize the Europeans." Fanon did not think much of the narcissistic monologues of the colonial bourgeois and their academics. Now the social scientists are getting hauled onto the carpet, or the efforts to jumpstart nations with theoretical knowledge invoked to regiment the masses according to predetermined schema, unquote. His prose drips with disdain, especially for the intellectuals who rid colonies of their European masters while having assimilated the colonizers' culture, and so authoring a kind of self-hatred that characterizes racial conflict in segregated societies. If some had worried about whether the revolution would be peaceful, Fanon had no doubt. It would not. It could not. As he mulled over his psychiatric case notes of obsessional neuroses and the pathologies of occipital lobes taken from a shattered Algeria, he became convinced that true liberation required a violent cleansing. Moving from Lyon to Algiers put him on the road to write one of the 20th century's most wrenching works, Les Damnés de la Terre. Written in Fanon's dying months from April to July of 1961, the book's wrath aimed to slice through the mist of development's false hopes. The Third World, he concluded, must start over a new history of man which takes account of not only the occasional prodigious theses maintained by Europe, but also its crimes. The most heinous have been committed at the very heart of man, the pathological dismembering of his functions and the erosion of his unity. And in the context of that community, the fracture, the stratification, and the bloody tensions fed by class, and finally, on the immense scale of humanity, the racial hatred, slavery, exploitation, and above all, the bloodless genocide whereby 1.5 billion have been written off. As with the unwinding consensus around around national welfare, confidence in modernizing development was also coming apart. In late 1964, Che Guevara traveled to Algeria to denounce what he called the bestiality of imperialism, and this, as it turns out, would be his last public appearance. He returned to Havana, not his last appearance, his last public appearance as an officer of the Cuban Revolution. He returned to Havana to pen his farewell letter to Fidel and to prepare for his suicide missions to the Congo and Bolivia. Oozing with nostalgia for a different development, Che reminded his compañero of the day that they met in Maria Antonia's house in Mexico, of the spirit of sacrifice to which they had vowed. "In a revolution," wrote Che in the letter, "one wins or one dies." Now it was time for him to take his hopes elsewhere. "I carry to new battlefronts the faith that you taught me, the revolutionary spirit of my people, the feeling of fulfillment of the most sacred duties, to fight against imperialism wherever it may be. This is a source of strength and more than heals the deepest of wounds." That year, Edmundo Desnoyers struck a less defiant, more resigned tone in his novel Memories of Underdevelopment. So development was now being replaced by a new diagnosis about underdevelopment. Echoing Dostoevsky's prose of doubt and isolation, Desnoyers' rendition of development uprooted his protagonist in the story, Sergio, without giving him new ground. I don't know if any of you have seen the filmic version of the novel, but Sergio wanders around Havana in a kind of fog after the revolution. Far from living in a Marxist or modernizationist certainties about phases and stages, Sergio wanders Havana in a limbo. Underdevelopment had become a state of mind. If Mariátegui had once imagined an integrated time of ancient and modern, a revolutionary Cuba dedicated to transcending the past with the development, leaves Sergio sighing. "The truth is, I feel washed out, sad with my new liberty solitude." As the fragile core of modernization broke up, some began to question the very concept of development altogether. Development was a threat. It was a menace, not because it fell short of its self-appointed hopes — that was Frantz Fanon's position — and not because it made the poor worse off — that was Huntington's position — but because it threatened to make everyone worse off. Development was destruction. And not surprisingly, this type of argument gained greater currency as the abundant 1960s gave way to the scarcity of the 1970s. In 1968, an Italian magnate and visionary summoned 30 scientists, statesmen, and intellectuals to form what would be called an invisible college known as the Club of Rome. The deliberations uncorked a project on the predicament of mankind to probe what was called the world problematique. Even before the OPEC crisis of 1973, the prevailing mood was no longer of an endless frontier of development possibilities. Not only was development in peril, it may be the enemy, tracking the planet onto a course of self-destruction. And so it was that the scientific certainties about progress unraveled, even as the travails of the Third World became more, not less, visible, thereby laying the intellectual groundwork for a political and social retreat from redistributionist concepts of justice. For the growing chorus of those finding fault with the world, the nub was not so much inequality as the precepts of what it had meant to be modern and prosperous. A generation started to extol the virtues of getting back to the land and the merits of the simplified life in a complex world, with Gandhi, I promised you Gandhi, as a poster child for anti-modernism, while conveniently dropping his anti-colonialism. The problem was that development purposefully aimed to drag people out of the village and rustic lives in order to be modern. Of course, they were quite right. This was the point. So a whole new set of words flow from this diagnosis. Simplicity, off the grid, micro-scale, diminutive houses, but above all, sustainable living. The terminology of a new generation of eco-warriors and their new social science. That Schumacher's essay in Buddhist Economics captured a cultural mood as energy prices rose and growth rates plunged was not an accidental convergence. Ever since Rachel Carson's sensational Silent Spring, has anybody read that? Okay. In 1962, and the blight of the killer smog in Los Angeles and London, what it meant to have a planetary consciousness had quickly evolved. The new vocabulary of constraint and limits accented the man-made crux of the problem, not nature's fetters. What is more, the limits were not posed by the myopia of traditional man. They were the result of the very actor who, Marx had predicted, was supposed to transcend necessity, modern man. History, thanks to our capacity to mold the planet to our consumption needs, had bent the curve of necessity back to where we started. Development, instead of freeing humanity from nature, took us off the cliff where we had to choose either to conserve or risk the future of the planet. The fundamental antagonism, therefore, had now changed. Once the struggles between the haves and have-nots, the new zero sum locked humans and the rest of the biosphere into a basic struggle over life. Under these circumstances, it became harder to raise the flag of development as a model of global redistribution. One of the field's pioneers would write an epitaph in 1979 called The Rise and Decline of Development Economics, in which he cheekily noted that the field had done much better than the object of its study. Time, he argued, had finally caught up with the discipline. Now, developmentalism and distributional justice did not go down without a fight. As many of you will know, there was an effort in the 1970s to create a new international economic order, the organization of OPEC, to try to redress this, what was seen to be the flow of resources from what we would now call the global south to the north. And, of course, all of these efforts failed. The irony, of course, is that few things demolished the bloc of underdeveloped countries more than the embourgeoisement of the sultanates and the growing debt of oil importers from the third world. And what emerged thereafter was a parting of ways in thinking about development to yield two main trunks from a shared root system of thinking about progress. Whereas so much development thinking over the course of the 20th century had shared a broadly similar attachment to the forward motion of history as one guided by purpose of human intervention, the confidence in grand schemes is gone. One of these is catastrophistic. Powered by a new planetary consciousness and the recognition of the common space of our Anthropocene, the history of modern life can be seen as a geologic chronology, one which has witnessed the imposition of one species over the rest, what Edward O. Wilson, the chief scientist of this turn, has called the social conquest of the Earth. The origins of modern humanity was a stroke of luck, good for our species for a while, bad for most of the rest of life forever, he concluded terminally. For a while, of course, is meant to remind readers that indeed the clock is still ticking, in fact running out, not as developmentalists of the 1950s feared for their half of the world while Americans filled their living rooms with televisions and the Soviets launched satellites, but for the species on the verge of losing its paradise. Unless humanity is prepared to conquer the Milky Way, it will have to reset its behavioral precepts. From competition and conquest to cooperation and collaboration, argues Wilson. The space once occupied by developmentalism as a critique of the global order's asymmetries has now been eclipsed by catastrophism. If Malthusian fears buttressed a tradition of arguments that something had to be done to redress global inequities, a new vein of thinking about population and species has been discovered. Building on the growing pessimism about planetary destruction, human evolution has conditioned the species for self-destruction. Now unfettered by rivals, humans threaten the ecosystem as a whole. This narrative of development as conquest has its polar opposite. The view that economic prosperity has been that which the West has so much to tutor to the rest. Call this the triumphalist option. This argument also has a vintage, though what is so surprising is how each generation rediscovers it for itself, thereby unwittingly erasing its earlier versions and counterpoints. Indeed, we started this whole talk this evening with Marx, whose preface to Das Kapital explained how the English experience of progress offered a map for those to come. De te fabula narratur, of you the future is told, Marx consoled his German readers. And ever since, the social sciences have recycled the idea that the first modernizers cornered the market on lessons of how to do it. Nowadays, with China joining the capitalist fold, the storyline has a familiar ring. Hernán de Soto, the Peruvian economist who gained fame for extolling the virtues of Latin America's swollen informal sector, joined the parade to unmask, reveal, disclose, shock. Unmasking, revealing. It's interesting, the choice or the tropes that authors now use as if they've discovered something really new here. To disclose the secrets of the world, his book is called The Mystery of Capital. Though this rendition was to accent the mysteries of the plot, one by one, revealing the clues to readers with a solution to the roman policier put together in the final act. Now, to his credit, it's the poor who concern de Soto, which is not the case over here, and it is for the have-nots that he believes his knowledge should be summoned. But if development has stumbled, it's because it failed to see that the mysteries of capital, according to de Soto, was that everyone should be a capitalist, regardless of creed or culture, indeed regardless of their capacities. The rest simply need to be more like the West and see everything as a potential possessive individualist. As with Wilson and Colbert, for De Soto, there's no alternative. It is, he concludes, the only game in town. Faced with such terminal narratives, change or go the way of the dodo bird, play the game or stay in your fetid shanty towns, there's not much room for complication. Yet in spite of their differences between them, the catastrophists and the triumphalists, what these arguments share is a retreat from the concept of redistribution at the conceptual core of global justice or our understanding of interdependence. Here I end. Like socialism, development is all but extinct. As a way to explain the global conjunction of inequity and integration, the two followed similar parabola, fading out with the waning faith in collective solutions to common problems. As things now stand, we lack a systematic way to explain how integration and inequality are entwined like DNA coils. This has given way to a chronic case of equality pessimism and a fog about how to reckon with the connections between capitalism and distribution. Moreover, without the moral vocabulary of global redistribution, it has become harder and harder to keep in the same frame what Marx had so vividly connected without blaming Wall Street rogues or Ivy League ideologues. Development talk, in effect, once accomplished both an analytical and a moral purpose. In its absence, we have an incoherence that can flatter the most committed absurdist. On one hand, there's the blood-boiling indignation of Naomi Klein and the silent fury about increasing concentrations of wealth and power. To others, development is little more than charity masquerading as community service. What Klein and the community service brokers share is the personalization of the problems, as if a world without Wall Street rogues would be a just one, as if the chasm that separates the privileged from the poor would close if we could just send more students to build houses in Honduras or divas to Africa. Faced with the complexity of the world and the inadequacy of our explanations, who can blame those who retreat to the simple conclusions that we have too many devils and not enough angels? In the old days, development was all about escaping traps. Now, all we have are gaps. But some gaps can be opportunities. The absence of development talk in our time, our globalization, affords an opportunity. But instead of enjoining a new debate, let me end by stating my own personal ambivalence. I realize it's not a really upbeat way to end a talk with ambivalence. In light of the horrors affected by styles of thinking that invoke historical laws for higher ends, I am reluctant to suggest that we go back to the drawing board of the past in search of usable patterns for an unclear future. On the other hand, without some compass informed by the past, our understanding of what connects global integration to global inequality will always be incomplete. Perhaps we might look to the events in public squares around the world nowadays for good reasons to rethink. Thanks very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Jeremy Edelman, professor of history at Princeton University. Professor Edelman's lecture was titled Development and the Global History of Distributive Justice and was presented by the Boston University History Department. Tonight's moderator was History Department Chair Bruce Shulman. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kahlo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.